Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for this week's Know Your Foe episode. Joining us, the one, the only, Jake Burns. Jake, thanks so much for joining us. I know a difficult season for the Cleveland Browns, but how are you doing personally?
You know, Ken, I'm tired. You know, it's funny. We do this, obviously, out of enjoyment of football and enjoyment of covering the sport and all that. But at the core, you really start covering the team because you enjoy the team, or you're from the city, or you grew up enjoying that team. And, you know, the Browns are a process that has been, you know, building for years. And you get to the point of these last few years that you start to have hope that they can figure something out meaningful, right? And I know you and I have had some pretty good discussions about some pretty good games in recent years, but I would say that this is at a low point. It's a hostile point for the franchise and the people who support it and trying to justify a lot of it. So, you know, we'll dig into all those details here in a bit, but it's just, it's been a tiring process this year for sure.
Now, the Browns are well known for having one of the most astute fan bases in all of football in terms of people who really understand the game and people who discuss it at a high level on various boards that you'll see, the water cooler even, which is supposed to be the kind of the least common denominator board over at 24/7, is a very high level discussion. And they have other boards that are intended to be even at a different level. But do you find that the environment is toxic, fan versus fan, when the current situation is going on? Or do you think there's almost like a built-in support group among Browns fans and the communities you have there?
Well, I would say it gets to this point with any normal situation where there's not toxic baggage that comes with the off-field stuff that I don't spend any time delving into or providing any analysis or opinion on. It's just not what I like to do about the sport. I just cover the X's and O's and whatnot. But when I think the way I would phrase it, Ken, is it is so divisive right now because of that extra baggage that it's less supporting. Even though I could make an argument that there was a unified case that they needed to move on when Deshaun was healthy, that they needed to just try a different route because he was playing so poorly. And we'll dig into the details of that. But like, that sort of felt semi-unified, but there's always a faction of folks who really support the player. And it was the same way with Baker Mayfield. You know, it's a little different, you know, when dealing with a very, you know, unified franchise quarterback. So you get factions of the fan base that stand up for that person, stand up for that player, and will go to bat endlessly. And I would say the overwhelming majority was ready to move on. I think what happened last week complicates things significantly, but I mean, to be completely blunt, I think it's one of the low points that this has been for people supporting where this is going since probably that 2017, 2018 area when it was kind of torn between asset collection, you know, total tear down asset collection mode and toward building up to something better, where I think then it kind of turned the corner for them for a little while when Baker Mayfield was drafted in that group, kind of Myles Garrett the year before. So it's just not healthy. And every fan base has a divide at sometimes, but this is just like, again, the stakes around that player and everything that comes with it makes people more hostile toward each other than ever. And it's just not a fun place to be.
You know, I get that. I also see that in Baltimore, there's a serious amount of name calling divisiveness about trying to get Lamar a championship. And it's you know, obviously the problem is different. I'm not trying to say, oh, we've got a bad problem in a relative sense, but the fan on fan contact I find occasionally quite toxic on this topic. You know, the notion that you know, big name receivers really need to be acquired because Lamar's never had a number one receiver, and you know, things like that. It's a very difficult process to go through with, and I'm torn between just not responding at all because I know engagement is going to be difficult, or you know, responding, and then there's you know, it can get into a long argument about what's, you know, what you should really be trying to do as a franchise. I have my own show for that. I don't need to argue it out with everybody on Twitter about this, but I know we share some you know, similar thoughts in terms of franchise building. The Browns at this point were in a windowed look at what they were doing, and they thought the acquisition of Watson would be give them a good Super Bowl window with a very good core of defensive players, certainly to go along with him, and a good core of offensive players for that matter. You know, good offensive line, Njoku, and you know, others that would give them a real chance to win a Super Bowl. You know, it's so far, you know, it hasn't worked out. But as this was starting, did it seem like people were fairly uniformly in favor of the Watson acquisition as it was, or were there a bunch of doomsayers at that time who said, "Oh, this is ridiculous. We're trading away the moon for this guy"?
No, I think from the time he was traded for, and it's there's levels to this. There's some people who walked away, Ken, entirely because of the allegations, and that is an understandable reaction to that whole endeavor. I mean, I get it. I'm not here to judge people on any way to feel about that. It's a very personal feeling, and I understand that. And I think it divided folks to, like, I know several people that work doing sort of loose Browns coverage and were involved in things who just said, I'm not following. I can't do this anymore. Mm. So there were folks that walked away. I think most folks that stuck around, were obviously those who, and I was of this belief too, that no matter how I feel about this or whoever, I'm not going to let one player take the Cleveland Browns from me. I've been a part of this, covering it, talking about it, thinking about it, being a fan of it for my entire life. And I'm not going to let that happen. Now, you can stomach things to an extent. You would agree with me that winning games changes the vibe for everything. If he's good and he can win games, you get into the area of Ben Roethlisberger, which is like, you get a franchise that although something maybe potentially heinous happened, you have people that will go to bat for you. They'll hang on to you, that you've done franchise legend things and you have a safe haven in Pittsburgh, and nobody will ever crack that, you know, foundation. But the problem is, what comes with that, and again, we'll talk about it later, what comes with the play and how that changes the perception. So what I would say is that at the time, I think everybody understood pursuing the quarterback, right? It was a highlight era for Watson in 2020. And we can talk about some of the risk factors I think that they ignored. And I certainly wasn't sitting there ringing the bell back then, because back then you were trying to convince yourself, I can stomach all of the national coverage that's going to be so negative about the player because the player is really good. So you can, you know, from my standpoint, I'm just breaking down what he did well, why he did it well, and can he do it here? And again, there are large conversations about the miscalculation of how that manifested itself in Cleveland. But back then, it was pretty much the way you stated, Ken, like they were a quarterback away. They felt like Mayfield was never going to be good enough to be that guy. And it was rare to find a 26-year-old quarterback who could be on the field, an elite player, and you could trade for him. And again, some things that we can look in the mirror and talk about that I think are fair, that maybe they even calculated and said, we're still okay with it. But at that point when the trade was made, if you were into the Browns and stuck around, you were okay with the trade because the player was just too good to argue back then. It was just like, you don't think he's good enough as a quarterback to justify this, because he was coming off a top five, top three, I think, actual PFF grade season, and 4,500 yards and a whole bunch of ludicrous stuff the way he was playing at that point. So, general unification around this guy is going to be pretty good. It's not a dumb trade from that standpoint. Unless, again, there were a hard contingent of Baker Mayfield fans who thought that was going too far, but that's going to happen with any, you know, sort of divisive player at that position. But yeah, that's where I think it was at that time. And then as things trickle forward and you know, they miscalculate the suspension length initially, and he misses 2/3 of the year instead of the first portion of the year, then it pushes into the injury risk factor, which again, are things we can hit on real quick at some point. But like, that's the stuff that you look back on it, you're like, oh, okay. They didn't really think about that entirely the way they needed to think about that. And that catches up with you. And that's that they're in the midst. And there's no doubt though, Ken, when the trade was made, it was universally accepted as far as the player. It was made sense. Kevin's offense, his way of approaching it, getting a quarterback who can uplift everybody around him instead of the offense having to carry him, that narrative, all that stuff in place. That all made plenty of sense. And I think at the time, again, it was pretty widely accepted that that was the way that they should go with it, from like, this is what they need to be a real championship contending team. And that part of it, if anybody says the other end of that, that they didn't believe that at the time, I think it's probably just folly, because you want to be down on it. But yeah, the process, I think, was fine.
Okay. So people would be revisionist if they did that. Let's move on to a happier topic, which is for Ravens fans. They really want to hear about the relationship between the Browns and Joe Flacco, Browns fans and Joe Flacco, in a lot of ways, both last year and this year. Obviously, enormous Cinderella story last year, almost like a George Blanda-esque story, coming in and right, helping to save the Browns season. Talk about that a little bit.
I think, Ken, it's hard, man. I mean, it's hard because Joe came in. Obviously, Joe tortured Cleveland for so long. And it's funny. Joe had that miraculous comeback. I wouldn't expect you or your fans to remember this game, but he was with the Jets. And in the 22 season, the Jets were down two touchdowns with under 2 minutes left, like a minute 20. Mm-hmm. And they hit a really big throw with like just under a minute left when they got the ball back, for like an 80-yard touchdown, recovered the onside kick, and then went down and scored again and took the lead. They were down 13 with like a buck 10 left and won the game. And after the game, Flacco was like, you know, it was quiet in here, but that's all I really know. That's all I've ever, you know, like, this is not an unnatural thing for me to hear Browns Stadium like that, because Joe had done so many, you know, to not just Cleveland, many places, but Cleveland pretty consistently, which is, you know, funny when you look back how bad the Browns were all those years. And then Joe, and like, it's funny, you're looking at Ben Roethlisberger's record in Cleveland Browns Stadium, and it's like, you know, that kind of matches up with the state of the franchise all those years. But it was great to see, like, it was just a reprieve is how I would say it, because they were really struggling. They were playing, as Deshaun left for the year with the shoulder injury, like PJ Walker and some guys of that nature who were just, they were tryhards, and that's fine. But you're like, are these guys going to make the playoffs? They were kind of hovering. Dorian Thompson Robinson was trying to do his best as a rookie, outmatched, and they were just kind of hovering 5-5, 5-6-5. And it's like, okay, man, this is going to run out. But then, you know, Joe arrives, and there's the whole, like, seeing Joe Flacco in a Browns helmet was pretty strange. And then he won the locker room so fast. People loved him. He was loved by the players. You could tell that he lifted the energy and the belief. Like, this guy is done this. He's done these big moments. He's won big games. He's got a Super Bowl ring on his finger. He's done these things. And from that, combined with how well he was slinging it, because you can't come in and stink and get the respect. Like, yep. He was slinging it. And it matched kind of perfectly with Kevin's traditional approach to offense, and everything melted together really well. And he endeared himself to his teammates. And through that, and through some great comeback wins they had, he won Browns fans over in a record time. So his ability to win Browns fans over in a record time was awesome. And then you had the tough decision, Ken, of like, we need to make a decision on what we're going to do with this guy, because this is a heroic story, but it's also a very tricky story, because Joe's pushing 40. And how much do you trust a guy to push 40 and do that again? Well, he's proven in Indianapolis, he's got some magic still left in him. But the biggest factor why they didn't keep him was that the starting quarterback would have felt uncomfortable, because the fans would have been clamoring for Joe. So I would say the experience was awesome. It was unique. It was great. And the Browns fans fell in love with the guy. And the unfortunate part of how much they fell in love with him and how much success they had with him is that ended up being a reason Cleveland couldn't bring him back. And I think obviously it's playing out, Ken, is the wrong decision, but like, that's the nature you get when you get into the world of Deshaun Watson.
So it wasn't just a narrative that I've seen online that, that somebody within the Browns echelon or ownership said that Watson was uncomfortable and that's not something we can live with. That's not just a narrative, that you actually believe that to be the case.
Yeah. I mean, could it be a narrative? Sure. But I mean, I don't know how you could look at that situation and not see it the way that it played out. Like, I think that when you look at, they obviously had Jameis Winston, who's a very similar quarterback to Joe stylistically. So if you say, well, they wanted a different type of quarterback, well, Jameis is very similar in terms of like ripping throws into windows the way Joe is. They just wanted somebody who, and Joe has been vocal about this, I'm sure you guys know, it's like, and it was that way with Lamar at the end of his tenure in Baltimore. He's like, I'm not here to train these guys behind me. That's not my job. My job is to start and win ball games, which I respect. And I think is just being real. And that, like, nature, they thought, I had to think, it's obvious, Ken, they can, they you could get them and put some truth serum in them and they would deny it, I guess, if you tried to, till you got some of that stuff in them. But like, you just, you couldn't do it. You couldn't do it because you were too committed and too pot committed. It's a sunk cost fallacy that's playing out in front of our eyeballs here. So they get Jameis, who's a similar quarterback if they wanted to turn to that type of quarterback, and also is the biggest boost your ego teammate probably put on earth. I mean, there's probably okay. nobody quite like him in that regard. So yeah, that's why they didn't bring Joe back. I mean, in an ideal world, I think you would have been able to realize the writing was on the wall with Watson and bring Joe back and just deal with the consequences, but that's not the world we're living in. But maybe Jameis, he's start this weekend. Maybe he does well too. I can't say that before Jameis gets a chance, but Joe's experience, Ken, was cool. It was really unique, and it was happy that Browns fans got to feel that for a little bit, because they, again, tortured Cleveland for a while in a big way. But I think again, very cool. Very cool to get a taste of it.
All right. Well, I think Ravens fans will love hearing that. You mentioned Jameis and how I saw his comments after the game where Deshaun was injured, just this, obviously this last week. Very vocal about, you know, talking about Watson and how he had, you know, really been supporting the city, been representing the city, and the notion of at least this is what I heard, and I did hear just a small clip of it, was, you know, you folks are idiots for hammering on this guy, or maybe not idiots, it's not very good behavior to hammer on this guy. Did Jameis win the rest of the clubhouse with that speech, do you think?
Probably, Ken. I mean, you would agree with me. You've probably seen it, maybe, and again, just kind of conjecture here, but back to the Ray Rice situation. Mm-hmm. When you get into the brotherhood of the NFL, these guys will protect their guys. They will not speak ill of their teammate. They will always step to the plate for them. And that's really they treat each other, you know, like family. And no matter how maybe somebody has done something ugly in your family or whatever, there you just go to bat for him, because what else are you going to do? This is your teammate. You show up every day together. And if I go tarnish his name in the media, what's that going to do for me? What's that going to do for guys around the league who have to step on the field and put their name on the line, their life on the line, essentially, because football is a very dangerous sport, and believe that I have their back, that I will do that thing for them. So should people be surprised that guys step in front of a microphone and said that? No. Shouldn't be, because that's how the NFL is wired. That's how most brotherhoods, Army, all those things, that's how they're wired.
Good point.
That's just the nature of the industry. Now, could the players have a little more perspective and just kind of no comment it? Maybe. But if you're asked that question and you no comment it, it probably doesn't look good either. So this is a lose-lose. And this is where I'm at, Ken, with it all. It's like the Browns are at the culmination of 25 years of tired fans. They sat through, upon the return in 99, really terrible football for two decades, outside of 2 years of unexpected. And in 2007, with Derek Anderson, Braylon Edwards, and a guy who proved to not be all too squeaky clean, Kellen Winslow, was a really good group. They came out of nowhere. They put it together and they had a playoff run, but they got cut short the last week. And it was a fun 10-6 year. Then they had a really flirty Kyle Shanahan 2014 year before it fell apart when they had to put Johnny Manziel in and it broke it off. But I'm telling you, those are the 2 years you can highlight. So you have 20 years 2002? Of a generation. I mean, that's just so early. So it was kind of, you know, you're right. It was the year they did actually make the playoffs, but it kind of felt so early. So even if you started in 2002 and you thought after 2002, this is it, man. We got this going. Tim Couch and Kelly Holcomb is probably blast from the past names your folks may recognize. There's something here. And then it fell apart. I never got back. Butch Davis is fired a couple of years later and it's done. And then even if you go from that to 20, it's like, that's like two decades. That's like a kid's entire growth watching a terrible franchise year in and year out, except for two little windows of this could be something, until it got to 2018, 2019, 2020 area, really tipping into 2020. And then you have, and again, I'm walking you through this. I'm gonna try to do it hastily. Like you have two years of like build up with Baker, and then you hire Kevin, you get that right. And then but before that, right before 16 and 17, those are 1-15, 0-16, bottoming out, going with this asset collection philosophy, losing consistently in front of your fans, 1-31. And then like you start to build and you see it, you can get the picture in your mind. You're like Miles and Denzel and all these guys are coming together. Maybe Baker's going to be great. He had that great rookie year. This guy's going to be unbelievable. And then it like is slowly reaches the point, Ken, which I know that this is something your folks are going to talk about until you win a Super Bowl, that this just might not be good enough. Like what they did is great. It's fun. It's got some nice, nice moments that matter, but this might not ever be good enough to win the ultimate prize. And what that happens is you start to feel people losing the hope. You lose the idea of how does this ever work? We went through 1-31 and we were supposed to be rewarded in a meaningful way. And then you get all of those emotions of two decades and a failed huge build that was supposed to push toward the playoffs because this quarterback you traded for was so bad that was supposed to be good. And you risked everything, your reputation, your NFL rep, every way everybody looks at this franchise. And then you get this moment and this year, and you can hear the tea kettle building. And you get to the moment this year where they just won't bench him. He's got historical data that says he's the worst quarterback this year and 562 quarterbacks since the turn of the decade. The offense of 756 offenses since the turn of the century. They're at the bottom of this list. Get bench this guy. They won't do it. And then he gets hurt. And your fans, you're in a maze, Ken. You're in a maze of torture that you just keep turning at every turn and you see the walls. How do I get out? And they were presented a door. That door could have been the most recent allegation provided the NFL a chance to suspend him and the Browns get out of it. Whatever the door is, they found one. That door, unfortunately, was a ruptured Achilles tendon. They felt for a moment, this is finally over. We can move on. We had a chance to move on. And that led to cheers. And I don't think people hate that. Nobody wants to see somebody suffer on a football field. That's awful. No, like, I can't say there are outliers in every facet of life, Ken, but they're like most people don't have an appetite for watching people suffer. And that's what they had to see. People see that and they hear the cheering and they think they're cheering him suffering. No, they're cheering the idea that this could be over. This experiment that has failed and nobody will pull the plug on could be over. So that's where it is. And that's where it gets to the injury for him and where this now we're in this weird, bizarro world where the Browns fans are being painted as the worst people in the world. And it's like, no, man, the organization that can't figure anything out has put these people at odds with their own players. Imagine a world where your organization has been so inept for so long that you then get to the point where you pit your desperate inside of a cage fans against now players coming at them publicly. And this is just a new low.
All right. That's very well explained, by the way, there. I don't want to delve any more deep into that. Let's talk about Jameis Winston a little bit and what you think he brings to the field as a quarterback.
Right. It's a good question and a tricky one because we just talked about Kevin Stefanski passing off play calling duties, which I'm sure you're going to ask about, but this has been a popular topic. So he hires Ken Dorsey. He basically rewrites his offensive staff this offseason because, and there's two thoughts to this, that he was told he had to, or he made the decision on his own. Hard to parse out at this point because there's a lot of who's making who do what in this environment. But he lets go of Alex Van Pelt, now the offensive coordinator in New England. Not that that's going swimmingly, but I think we could agree the talent there is pretty shallow. You know, there's other names that they let go. Stump Mitchell, longtime running back coach, his tight end coach, and the year before that, Drew Petzing left to take the OC job in Arizona. But he basically rewrote his initial staff for the first time in 4 years and brought in a bunch of different people. He brought in Ken Dorsey, who was obviously let go from Buffalo for Joe Brady, brought him in to be the OC because of his experience with some of these quarterbacks of the nature, Josh Allen, Cam Newton, a similar sort of stylistic approach to Deshaun. And then added some others. Tommy Rees came as the tight ends coach. He came from Alabama, where he was Notre Dame and then Alabama's OC. Got a guy from the East Coast who was at Rhode Island, then at UConn, who's done some really unique stuff, named Nick Charlton. Brought him in to be an offensive line analyst. A tough one that they lost was Bill Callahan, who heads to coach with his son, Brian, in Tennessee. So they did let him out of the contract because who's going to tell a guy he can't coach with his son who got a head coaching job? So you really rewrote everything. They brought in Andy Dickerson, a guy from out in the West Coast in Seattle. They brought him in to be the offensive line coach. And from that, it's been kind of a mess. They have been very disorganized, really poor in the operation side has been sloppy. A lot of illegal shifts, a lot of personnel issues getting in and out of the huddle. And everything pre-snap has been sloppy. And then everything post-snap has been disjointed. Now, it hasn't all been Deshaun Watson. You don't get to the worst offense of the century, possibly, with one person being the culprit, because you would get Andy Dalton into the game and fix the next week if it was just one person. The way Bryce Young struggled is a great recent analogy. It is a culmination of everybody failing. It's a lack of 11 guys doing their job enough on plays to make it work, right? One play, it's the left tackle doesn't finish the play. The next play, it's the wide receiver drops it. The next play, Watson's too panicked because of his recent history with like this offensive line to see it and process it out. It's just it's a collection of failures. Running backs are bad in pass protection the next play. So it gets to this point and, you know, largely they rewrote it to fit how Ken has run offense. The downfield passing game is very much his. They do some things in the run game that are similar to Kevin's tenure. A lot of still do a lot of tight zone wide zone variations. They'll do some gap power stuff. It's not totally written, but that's not unexpected when Ken, more of a, in Buffalo, was more of the pass game designer. His O-line coach developed the O-line, the run blocking stuff. That's very common. But they developed RPO stuff that was built around Ken. Largely, it's Ken's offense. So the idea was like, is Ken going to call it because that's his baby, or is Kevin going to run it? And that was the big point of discussion before the year.
Okay. So it is Ken's offense already. So the reason why I want to ask this question is that Ravens fans, I think, can understand how things can go very wrong and get very disjointed with a bunch of coaching departures, because that's exactly what's happened to the Ravens pass defense from 23 to 24. They lost the defensive line coach, the secondary coach, and the defensive coordinator, all who were very good and went on to great jobs elsewhere. The issue that I think a lot of Ravens fans had poised is that McDonald should be made somehow head coach in waiting, like that would have been enough because he just got a huge contract from Seattle for what he did. So, well, he wasn't going to wait after that occurred, or that they should have just fired Harbaugh now and made McDonald the head coach, which would be a big bet on a young guy and really a very good player. But the big thing that they pointed to was that, or that some are pointing to, that I think is the one good point in all of this, is that if your head coach also calls one side of the ball, then you have an inherent advantage of stability that you can maintain over time. And I think there is some validity to that. I also think having a coach who knows how to hire other coaches and really will make the case for who he wants with the owner is tremendously valuable. And I think that probably is worth even more if you can have that. But you're saying Stefanski brought in Dorsey. Dorsey was the offense creator, is his offense. So they weren't going to promote Dorsey to replace Stefanski, or at least not yet. Let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. Kevin has a couple coach of the years under his belt. Like he's established some cachet here that he can do this. He can call offense. He can take Jacoby Brissett and put him into a top 10 EPA group. He's done this. Now, the miscalculation, the bigger conversation about Deshaun Watson, is how well would he be able to adapt to Deshaun? And I think that has been the problem. They have not been on the same wavelength about how the play caller sees the field with what the quarterback is seeing in conjunction and the sequencing, et cetera, et cetera. I think that was something that we all glossed over, myself included. I really don't know, when you look at Deshaun's tape in 2020, how you could not solve that. But again, if you track it back further, Deshaun missed the entire 2021 season. He missed the first 11 games of 22. That's a significant amount of time off. You couldn't rewrite an offense in 22 that had to be two-thirds of the season somebody else at quarterback. And then he gets hurt in 23, misses 12 games. He's like a rookie, Ken. He's rewriting how to handle pocket presence again because he has missed so much time. And you couldn't really build the cohesion between play caller and quarterback because, again, the guy missed so much time. So I understand the reasoning for what they did. They brought these people in who they thought could adapt an offense built, tailored, I should say, more to what Deshaun does well. The miscalculation was that Deshaun isn't really ready to handle that right now. He actually needed somebody to hold his hand in a more significant way. And that led to, obviously, what we're at right now. So my theory has been since the beginning of the year, Kevin's going to keep calling plays. It's a completely stylistically different thing from what he's done. So that's an interesting choice, because I would think logically, hand that to Ken, let Ken run that, and you can collaborate with him. You can work with him. Well, they didn't do that. The process stuff stinks. There are too many penalties. There's too many miscommunications, and it leads to where we are right now. And Kevin, I think, got to the point where he's like, you know, I could be a CEO of a team, and you get to a little 1-6, Ken, you could agree, get to some job preservation stuff here too. You start to think about, what's the perception of me? Can I get another job here, there, or the other? And like from that angle, which I just did a long podcast on this topic, it's like you get to the point where you're like, well, maybe Ken's just better at it than me and I should hand it to him. And if it works out well, I get praised for being selfless and et cetera, right? If it goes poorly the rest of the way, then look, it's not my fault. He couldn't figure it out either. I think originally what the plan was on good faith was like, hey, Kevin's going to be a little rough at this. They laid breadcrumbs telling people the offense was going to need a little bit to figure it out. But you thought you had early season games against the Cowboys kind of in conjunction with like losing CeeDee Lamb's in camp late. And you got a lot of opportunities, Giants, Raiders. At the time, perception wise, the Commanders, like there were some games that you could be rough. The defense could carry you and you could get to 3-1, you know, 2-2 or 3-2, whatever, and have a real chance to come out of it for the better. You get better. Your offense gets better midseason toward the end. Just it never happened. It never panned out. So now you're in this rough spot, and it's largely something that Kevin has proven he can't handle very well. So let's let Ken call things that are clearly more for him, and Kevin gets to CEO it. I mean, like, I think you're right, Ken, about the nature of like having a play calling head coach that can help keep stability, keep things clean. But I also think we're losing the bit of the forest through the trees with this. It doesn't have to be. And this is the funny thing about, and this is my opinion of the NFL. Like, you obviously having an elite quarterback helps and matters. It's great, but you can do things that matter as well without that guy as you work toward finding him. So I'm not going to sit here and write off the idea that you can have guys like John Harbaugh, guys like Jim, guys like Mike Tomlin, who can find immense amount of success because in Andy Reid, these guys who can rewrite and teach their coaches how to do the things they want. That is a really powerful skill to be able to do. And I think Kevin can still, I think the organization can view him that way, but he has to prove it. Like there's got to be if you're going to pass this off, are you getting rid of the virus everywhere else? Are you helping improve the special teams? Is the defense going to consistently play with effort? Is the operation side of things going to get better for the offense? There are things that as a guy analyzing a 1-6 team, you can pick apart to see, did Kevin the rest of the year sit like a bump on the log, or was he improving the operations of everything around him? And then obviously ridding them of, I think, is a really toxic virus of disbelief. They don't have belief they can do it right now. So that's the hardest thing he has to do. I personally think Kevin has developed the ability to be a CEO, believing in this guy, like a guy who you go to bat for. They won games against the odds, Ken, so many times last year. They had no business winning. I think guys will play hard for him, but they have to get some belief. Your offense, one side of the ball can only be so bad. If it's that bad, the virus is like, I mean, I don't mean to be callous here, but it's like a tumor. You can't get rid of that. You can't overcome that. But if you can get that out of the muck and lift it to even just like a bottom 10 group instead of a bottom group, you have a chance to win in the muck. And the Browns defense is good enough to win in the muck if they can get some belief that they're going to get some help. So I just color me very curious about how Kevin handles that role, because the AFC North provides examples of you can win with that role if you have the right guy at the forefront of the operation.
Yeah. All right. Fantastic. Extremely well explained. So in terms of Jameis going back to him, there's just not enough to go on right now as to know what he'll be. Let's just move on here and talk about the receivers and who's available. I know the Amari Cooper trade was what.
Well, I'll say one thing about Jameis. I did not mean to interrupt you, but like we're really interested because he was the backup quarterback all year, Ken. They played week 7. What is that? We just had week 7. He played week 6 in Philly. He's been there like short yardage quarterback, comes in, quarterback sneaks, and will do some of those operation things on very, very tight short yardage. And they ran this jet sweep on a 3rd-and-1 under center, hands it off to Cedric Tillman, who we'll talk about. And it got foiled. The Eagles jumped it. And after the game, Kevin Stefanski said that was a miscommunication, which is very out of the ordinary for him to elaborate on a play. He's very tight-lipped, very buttoned up about this stuff, never throws a player under the bus. And he didn't directly throw him under the bus, but it basically sounded like the Jameis maybe freewheeled that, made that call on his own. And the next week, he's benched for Dorian as the backup. And we've heard a local radio guy who's in-house in Cleveland but does radio in Columbus too, has mentioned that the organization was fed up with him, with Jameis. It's a passerby comment, but he is also in the know. So it's not nothing burger. So like, that's interesting. And then I got to thinking about this, Ken, and maybe you recall, maybe your people do, maybe they don't. Last year, New Orleans played Atlanta late in the year and they scored a touchdown at the end of the game on the goal line when they would just normally knee it out. And after the game, it was Jameis saying he ad-libbed that. He called it in the huddle. No one gave him the play. He called that. It's very much on social media. You can find it anywhere. And he just basically said he apologized for it, but he's like, I did that. I called that. I think there's some stuff here where Kevin maybe also doesn't really like him. Like he said today that he's a different type of leader. He's a different type. It just like Kevin's comments, you got to really like squint at him. But when you squint at him, you can see it. And I think there's a little maybe reality from Kevin that, hey, man, this guy's not my type of guy. Maybe Ken can handle him better the rest of the year and we'll see what happens. But again, you're talking about when you're 1-6, Ken, you got to think through like what are the areas of interest get a little different. And I think this is an area that I'm certainly drawn to seeing how it plays out, because those are a bunch of weird circumstances to see. Because you could agree with me. I mean, Jameis is funny and unique, but I could also see him being a guy that could drive a coach crazy too.
if he did that sort of thing, that would be the kind of thing I would be afraid in Baltimore would put him in the Harbaugh doghouse and he'd never get out. You know, if you just that's insubordination, and it would be a cultural rift that would be created by that. It wouldn't be anything that John, I don't think, could live with. Harbaugh is a very similar coach in terms of his actions at the podium. Extremely tight-lipped. Won't give you anything meaningful on injury. In fact, I think you should even go further there and just say go with what the rule is in business when you're talking about any kind of M&A work is. Mm-hmm. Your only comment is no comment. So you can't say, no, it's not a serious injury, when then it kind of means that it is a serious injury when you don't say that any other time. So he probably could go even further on that, but he wants to give the media just a little bit of something. He's kind of has there's maybe a small need to be liked that's in there that a lot of coaches have. But he also, you have to decode a lot of times what he's saying. And there's pure coach speak that you give to any player. And that's any player who's between 3 and 51 on your roster, we'll call it. Okay. And then you have a couple of guys who you go into this alliterative talk, and they're the most special athlete ever. And he'll do that about Lamar Jackson. He did it a long time ago about Chuck Clark, who was one of his favorites. And then there's other guys, the last two guys on the roster, he can be really salty about them. And he'll give you some comment and you go, okay, I'm decoding that. That means he's yet. So anyway, I hear some of that in what you're talking about with Stefanski in terms of what you're doing to decode that. Yeah. That's also really respect that as a skill, by the way, you, Jake.
Right. And I think those guys, and there's some emulation, I think, that happens there. You see how these guys handle their business. And he was around some good coaches in Minnesota when that's his upbringing, largely Minnesota, the Kubiaks. And he's, you know, around Zimmer and those guys. So he knows how to play that game. But I mean, yeah.
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home-baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.
Evan, from like even how Tomlin's a little more, I guess, crass is the way to put it, but he doesn't give away anything. He does his own flair on it. But those guys are skilled at saying nothing without saying it. But you also know, like, when it sounds irregular, you know to pay attention to it. And that's kind of what happened with Jameis's, the quote about Jameis today and the miscommunication thing that happened where he said, oh, we'll get it fixed. And the fixing was the actions. We're you know, you're our third guy now. You're not going to be active on game. So that is significant as we look at now, maybe Jameis starting for a stretch of games because Dorian hurt his, he had a tendon injury in his hand. So yeah, they're looking at starting Jameis for a little bit here.
Okay. Let's go through the offensive line in its current state. I know one of the best, over the last few years.
It's a disaster. It's a disaster. Things have fallen apart in a big way, man. I found myself watching tape from the Bengals game last week and I'm like genuinely jealous of the Bengals offensive line. And I'm like, man, I am in an upside down world. Yeah. They're playing good football, man. Protecting Joe really well. So I mean, Jedrick Wills, the left tackle they drafted, the top 10 overall, and what was that, 2001 now? Maybe it was 2020, I think, at this point. 2020 has never panned out. Came into the year, they took a risk on a couple things. They have three offensive tackles who are playable: Jed, Jack Conklin, and Dewan Jones. All three of them had season-ending surgery last year, and that was obviously brutal. They lost Jack Conklin the first game of the year on a collision where a player came around from the opposite edge and slung around into his knee. So his ACL was done, and a lot of rebuilding of that entire knee. Jed lost the season about week 9 for the year. He had a knee surgery, and then the same for Dewan. They weren't devastating injuries, but they were serious enough. So he went into this year. Dewan was back early, but it was clear the knee was still bothering him. He's a really big fella from Ohio State. I have to think he was pushing over 4 bills. So he has regressed. He's not, the speed threat for him is not there the way it used to be. They didn't have either Jack or Jed for the beginning of the season. The first 4 weeks of the season, they missed both of those guys. So they were playing James Hudson, who has since also gone on to IR for the year with the shoulder surgery. So they were playing a really bad left tackle until Jed came back. Jed is back now. Jack is also back. Jack did leave last week early. We'll see what comes of it. So Dewan hasn't been very good. You haven't had Jack Conklin, who was ready to come back like week 5, then had a hamstring injury and it pushed him back a couple weeks, but he's back. We'll see what that looks like. He played relatively well the other day, but he's restructured both knees over the course of his career. You get the caveats that come with that. Jed has never panned out. Good week the first week back. Last week was the worst game I've seen from him in a pro football uniform. So inconsistent, and really just a bummer to watch a top 10 pick never really reach the potential you thought he had. So the tackle situation has been extremely rough, and I don't have much confidence in it.
Okay, so for next year, Wills is not under contract. He's got his board years coming up, and I don't know what that means for the Browns there. But at right tackle, Conklin, they haven't restructured him. He's like the only guy, pretty much, they haven't restructured in terms of his $2025 dollars.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to play Dewan, I'd imagine, try to keep working through that. I don't know if Jack will be back. I think they can find a way to work through that. I don't know. I really don't. I mean, you want to spend an early pick on maybe a really good wide receiver, or at this point, you're looking at maybe drafting a quarterback. So like the idea of taking a tackle is on the market too, because they don't have anything solidified on the left side at left tackle. So that's a giant mystery. But you know, you would like in a contract year, somebody like Jed to play with some real urgency and earn a second contract, or at least a one year, $9 million something. I mean, at this point, Ken, he's pushing toward like somebody's going to take a year risk on him somewhere. It's going to be very cheap, but it's like just because he's a top 10 pick and he's got some of those athleticism traits, but there's nothing there. This technician side of it is not any good. The effort side is poor. Like it's a mess. It's really sad that it's worked out that way. But the tackle thing is in flux both now and into the future, which is never something you ever like to enjoy as a someone breaking down the team. The guard stuff has been rough too. They lost Wyatt Teller after the second week, the third week, which is their best offensive guard. It's been pretty consistent for them the past 4 years. But he did just get put back on the pathway to come back, the 4-week window. I don't know that he'll come back this week. I doubt that, but they've been missing him. So they've been starting a rookie named Zach Zenter, who they took in the third round. Ironically, a couple picks before Dominic Pooney, who's turned out to be really good in San Francisco and a little bit out in front of the kid. His name escapes me, in Pittsburgh right now, playing really good football for them, one of the Dakota schools. But Zenter's not been very good. He had a serious leg injury that he was coming back from, suffered it against Ohio State, and has not looked good. I mean, but they've started him and Michael Dunn at right guard, and it's been some of the worst guard play in the league in that stretch. Ethan Postick is center, has been around for a little while, took over for J.C. Treader back in the day about 3 years ago, and he's got ups and downs. He's definitely not as good as consistent as J.C., but you understand the contract they gave him and why they like him, and he was good last week. We'll see if that translates again, but he's fine. Joel Bitonio at left guard is just getting old. Joel doesn't post up the way he used to be able to anchor. He gets bull rushed on people now. Just he had back issues last year that start, you know, once you're back and you're an interior O-line, man, that stuff gets hard. He's pushing through, and he's such a franchise legend, and it's just tough to watch him not be the elite guy he always was. But he's playing hard and he's giving it his all, but he's just so much more beatable. In his peak, he was like a basketball player trying to get around a like cement block basketball player, and it's just not that anymore for him. So collectively, Ken, it's been a failure. That's been the disappointment. We all wanted to really spend the early part of the year to the mid part of the year judging Deshaun Watson. How does the quarterback, and they have not given the type of protection that you would like to have a fair judgment there. So that's been disappointing.
All right, fair enough. Bitonio headed for the what's the Browns Ring of Honor called.
Yeah, I think that's what they call it, the Ring of Honor too. Because I don't think they Petonio get crazy
headed
with it.
There for certain.
For sure. I mean, there was a chance a couple years back he had made another All-Pro. Like, you could see a pathway to the Hall of Fame, but it's not going to work. He's not the same player. He's not aging the way he would need to, maybe two or three more years of that elite tier stuff. But he was certainly, I mean, the second he's done, he's with, you know, this era for them. It's like him and Joe Thomas. And if they would have been able to keep Mitchell Schwartz for a while, they ended up letting him go back in the day. But yeah, those were kind of all brought in around the same realm. So yeah, Joel's special dude too. Really good guy.
All right. Let's talk about the receivers and obviously the trade of Amari Cooper. Your critique on the trade for starters?
Well, it's a bummer. I mean, you're giving up on your season after 5 weeks is essentially what you did. You know, that indication. I get why they did it in a vacuum. You're not having a good year and he's under a contract for one more season. And at that point, it's like, it's okay. It's okay to ship him off because your season's kind of headed in one direction and you could get something back for a guy who's going to walk out the door, you know? So it's nothing more than a bummer to me. He was not playing well. I think he was having issues with the way they signed Jerry Jeudy to a bigger contract and didn't update his money. And that led to some, you know, trepidation from him. And yeah, they restructured and gave him some more upfront money and some things like that. But you just tell something was off from the early part of the year and he didn't play well. He wasn't moving as fast as he traditionally does, dropping footballs he's never dropped before. It was for the best. At the point it was for the best. The problem is that, you know, you're giving up on a weapon for identifying at the time before Watson was hurt. The trade was made before that like you need to see what this quarterback can do. So that was tough to stomach. Jerry Jeudy has been okay. I mean, the quarterback and the offensive line haven't helped to provide opportunities for him downfield. I think he's been fine. The jury's still out on what that ultimately looks like. They've gotten next to nothing out of Elijah Moore, who's more of an inside out player for them. Just as like, he's just a guy who doesn't seem interested all the time. And he's just never been quite as shifty or able to make people miss in the way that I really hoped. So he hasn't panned out. He's probably off the roster next year because his rookie deal will be expired. They play rookie Cedric Tillman more last week out of Amari's situation. Cedric is a nice player. Where's number 19? He's a nice size guy. He's been disappointing coming. I don't know how much you study this, but Josh Heupel's offense there at Tennessee is where he came out of, right beside Jalen Hyatt, where they were really explosive that year. But that offense is so that veer stuff, the split veer stuff where you're playing real wide hash marks on the side. It doesn't really teach you how to process through the game. So he had a real rough time his rookie year understanding route adjustments and landmarks and the little parts of the position. It's year two. It's been a little better. Still some mental lapses that happen there, but I certainly don't mind giving him the year to see if he can continue to get better in a feature role. But that's a guy that they need to get better. They need to be able to count on him.
One question about Tillman, is he at the pro level been a good back shoulder guy? Has he been a guy who's typically lined up at an X and been able to turn and catch the football, been smart about where to be when that happened?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, he's a big guy. He's got a nice frame, but he has not been able to like work back shoulder completions. He doesn't high point it well, and I have not seen much evidence of that. Now, could he get more opportunity to get better, Ken? Sure, but I haven't seen that from him. He's very much a catch it in front of his face player at this point. If he goes up over somebody and catches it, or if he does dance back shoulder and hit the toe touch stuff, that would be a surprise. Like, he's not shown that enough to feel confident in. They played Jamari Thrash, a rookie from Louisville, too early to really know. Hasn't played much at the start of the year. Now, Amari's departure gave him a little bit more opportunity, but he's a smaller body type. They'll play him probably more Z than anything else. Let him move around, put him in motion, do some things like that. But it's not a very good wide receiver group right now, collectively. I mean, it's just, but again, it's a byproduct of a bad passing game. I am interested to see if they have somebody back there who, instead of seeing everything open, will just give them chances to catch a football with somebody covering them, right? I think that's been the biggest issue, is they also haven't had many chances. So I'm curious what that could be like if Jameis is willing to rip those.
All right. Very good. Now, Nick Chubb returning to the running back position. Oh, let's talk tight end first. I don't want to jump out of the receivers entirely. Besides Njoku, what does Cleveland have?
Well, David missed a little bit at the beginning of the year. Getting him back matters to them so much. They like to live in 11 personnel now, which has been such a different thing for them over the years. They're actually getting a couple more tight ends involved. So, you know, when you lose David, though, it hurts because he's so multifaceted. He's one of the best two-way tight ends, I think, in the game when he's right and locked in and they have an offense that's functioning well. He missed after the Dallas game. He missed 3 or 4 weeks with a high ankle sprain, but he's come back and he seems okay, but it's a little high ankle sprains are brutal. But Jordan Akins, a veteran who's been around the league, mostly specifically with the Texans for a while, who's an athletic pass catcher type, you know, late joining, I think played baseball for a while. Then he went to UCF old and came into the NFL a little older, but he's fine. He's nice. So be a complimentary piece. They'll play him a little bit. And then when they want a third tight end, they'll bring in a blocking guy named Jeff Swaim, who they claimed off of, I think, Arizona's practice squad earlier in the year. The negligence at tight end has been fascinating. Kevin's faded away from it over the years. They ultimately didn't even have a third tight end on the roster for a while. So that's been something that we've been kind of mystified by, and seeing if they're going to work in the opposite direction of that, because they invested in Harrison Bryant in the draft, the former Mackey winner there at Florida Atlantic, but they ultimately let him play out his rookie contract and go to Las Vegas. So different philosophical change, but I'm curious if that moves around a little bit in the coming years.
And they didn't have a fullback on a roster with only two tight ends also?
No, they would use, ironically enough, they would use a line. Kevin likes to plug in extra linemen, play him out there when he's going to use that. They played Nick Harris.
Nick Harris, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, who they let go of after his rookie deal. He went to Seattle. Then there was the injury to Luke Whipler, who they drafted. He broke his ankle. So when he broke his ankle, they traded back to get Nick Harris, like some late swap in years in the future, and got Harris back. And they play him at fullback a little bit. And then he started for a couple games. Posick was out, and then he broke his ankle, I think. So he's had terrible luck. He was supposed to start that year, Deshaun's first year, 22. And then the first preseason game, tore his ACL. That gave Posick a chance, who earned the job, took a new contract. And then, you know, Harris is getting a chance to start again and then breaks his ankle. But they were using him. They're using like Winston Reed, who's a tight end, whereas number 59 is an extra body in goal line. They're doing some weird things. So no fullback, not even a fourth tight end. They use extra offensive linemen. They play six offensive linemen. Sometimes they've done seven. And then they've done the unicorn, which is the eight offensive linemen, where you bring two of them on the outside, a fullback in the backfield, and you get real funky with it. So they'll get weird there, but they're also running out of bodies to play those extra offensive linemen in a meaningful way. So they'll probably put, if they do that, they'll put a tight end back there like Swaim and run it that way. But they don't get into that world too often.
Let's roll back to the running backs again. The return of Nick Chubb, got to be very exciting.
It's just cool. I mean, a guy who loves Cleveland and people love him. And yeah, I mean, you know, Ken, I wouldn't imagine your folks watched it or saw it. Maybe they did. It was a primetime game, but that was one of the more grueling knee injuries I've ever seen, man. On top of his injury at Georgia, which was unbelievable, in the same knee. And so he wrote a letter, a really cool letter about him as a person, which I would encourage, even if you're not a fan of the Browns, like, just Nick is a universally loved NFL player. And he wrote in the Players Tribune a really cool article about his life, his growth, his beliefs, and what draws him to Cleveland, and how the organization said that at the time they could have cut him. You know, there's no guarantees left in his contract, but basically they told his agent, we can't cut you because the city loves you too much. Like, we didn't even entertain that idea because the city loves you so much. So it's a special bond he has with this place, and they love him. Is he the same player? I don't know. They only ran him 11 times last week, had to come from behind, so that's natural, but he seems okay. We'll see when things get a little more open fieldy, how that looks, or if he has to make that really drastic cut, how that looks. But just cool to have him back. It's cool to have him back. They let Kareem Hunt go this past offseason, brought in Deontay Foreman. It's not been a good experience. Deontay just seems very ho-hum. I mean, just very average to below average. That hasn't panned out. Jerome Ford, who's hurt right now, he had a hamstring injury in week six. Didn't play week 7. Don't think he's going to play this week either. Is just a very average running back at the NFL level. Doesn't block well at all, so that limits things. But he's been asked to a lot, which is a bummer. But he has not been as good as they hoped he would be out of Cincinnati. Just hasn't really developed, blossomed. He's fine. He's just ultimately like a very average second or third running back who's been playing a lot because of Nick's injury. And then they have a young man named Pierre Strong who came over from New England right before last year's start, and they're playing him a lot lately because they've had to. They, you know, virtue of, hey, we don't want to play Nick here, but we maybe want to play somebody with a little more speed or burst. So, I mean, Nick is whatever Nick is compared to what he used to be. And then you have, I think, some guys who are just very average NFL running backs, Ken, to below average.
All right. Let's talk about how the Cleveland may try and break down, or Stefanski or Dorsey, whoever is doing it, will try and break down the Ravens defenders. They've had some problems at inside linebacker with coverage that caused them to move to the dime as their primary pass defense. Now they've been playing it, you know, a high percentage of the time. When I say that, it's still like 35% to 40%, but that's the second most they've ever played it in team history. How do you see them trying to break that down? Cleveland run a lot of bunch formations, or do they do less of that than, say, the Bengals or the Steelers?
Right. That's a great question. I know I'm on here to know your foe, but Kim, when I tell you I have no clue, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they're going to alter everything because of what maybe is Jameis's preference. What I would imagine they'll do is they'll play heavier personnel and they'll try to run it and they'll try to get some under center play action stuff moving. Get your backers to move. I call it different. There's a difference to me between play action and run action. Run action, you get all 11 guys committed to selling run before you throw it. And then there's, you know, standard play action to me is just a flash fake. Or if you're under center, your guys up front are pass blocking and you're flashing the ball to your running back to maybe influence an inside backer, hold somebody down. I expect them to run action a lot, run the football a lot, and try to lean into things they can create off of that. The problem with the Browns offense this year, more than anything else, is their average down to go or yards to go on third down. They're putting themselves into more third and eight plus than any team in the league by a mile. So they're going to try to do everything they can to eliminate that. So what I think comes off of some formations that I think will be condensed to your original question is they try to create as much eye candy as they can this week to stress some open opportunities.
Okay, just let's go back to the term run action for a second. You're all 11 guys trying to sell the run. I think of that as typically you're mostly naked boots as the Ravens or many teams would run it. So you get a zone block look going one way. It always helps if your team's a good zone blocking team doing that. So Cleveland, I think, would fit into the certainly that mode, Atlanta, other teams. And then you usually are having the quarterback roll out through the back door. Flacco did it a lot because, and I think non-mobile quarterbacks have a big advantage at that. Is that most of it, or is there a straight drop from?
Yeah, they like to pull the backside guard. So they'll gun run action, which is pulling the backside guard and having guys usually on in breaking initial steps to emulate gun run. So for me, I consider when you're pulling a backside guard and you're down blocking and sliding, that is everybody committed to selling gap gun run game. So I label that run action because usually you're going to have some sort of crisscross meshing concept that emulates guys working inside to block people. So they will gun run in that variety. You'll see a backside guard pull. They did it last year a lot with Joe, ironically, Flacco, where they would pull the backside guard. They did it because both of their tackles were fourth, fifth string guys, practice squad elevations. And it was like, hey, we want to set up and push the routes downfield. How do we get time for that? Well, what we do is we put two talented guards, Joel and Wyatt, and we say, okay, we would rather pull them and leave them on an island with that really talented defensive end instead of a practice squad type talent player and slide everybody and work toward the opposite side and leave them on an island and create off of that a little semi bootleg where you're rolling the quarterback at a little bit. And that just gives those downfield routes the time they need to develop.
Right.
They will still do that. I don't know the nature of volume, but they will do that. And they'll do that from under center too, not just bootleg stuff. They'll definitely have them turn, look like it's running duo, and then push off of that, sell off of that, like that backfield stuff where you're blind to the defense and whipping your head back around. But they'll also, I can't imagine they will just abandon the RPO stuff. They run it at a high rate because that's what Ken Dorsey is, and that's what they wanted to do with Deshaun. So I do think you will see some more traditional 11 personnel, 3x1 or 2x2s, where they are looking to stress some guys in different spots and try to put some conflict in place to either open up some run game stuff where you're taking a guy out of the fit because he has to hold down a backside hitch or a backside glance. Something of that nature will be a part of it. I don't think they abandon that entirely, but I do think the volume and what I would be planning for as a Baltimore coach is, okay, Jameis does this well. He's more of a traditionalist. He's going to be in the gun. He's going to 5 or 3 off the gun. He's going to punch out from under center. If they're going to bootleg him, it's going to be more of, I think it's going to be as much volume of under center as can stomach based on game situation. You know, you can't do that stuff if you're down 21-3 right off the rip. But I think in an ideal world, the Browns would like to live that way because that's where I think they think their best opportunity is.
Okay. Sounds like an important game for the backside edge defender. Not that it's ever not a game for the backside edge defender not to be aware.
Right.
But it's an important game for that. All right, let's float over the defensive side here, and I really appreciate you taking all this time, and I want to respect your time and not have you talk in front of the 35 minutes on the defense here. So let's go a little quicker. What's the most common pass defense look? What personnel do they want on the field, and how do they deal with it?
Yeah, they'll play three guys, three corners. They'll live in nickel, so it's Denzel Ward will play outside, Martin Emerson will play outside. They'll play Greg Newsome in the slot. That's their three guys, their steady presence. When they want to get funky, they'll do some dime stuff and bring a third safety on. So they'll play some of that stuff here and there. But the guys have been a little beat up and out of the situation. So they've been a little restricted. But they use Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah as a wild card there who can play everywhere. He does a bunch of different things for them. I think he's playing some of the best inside linebacker football in the game. But to do your defensive back stuff for you, those are your three corners. Denzel Ward is at the peak of his powers. I think, again, it's kind of a bummer because I think the 1-6 hurts, but You have Denzel and I think JOK are playing all pro level football, which is really hard to stomach that that's going to be ignored because of the situation. But that's it. And they'll play two safeties a lot of times. Juan Thornhill just came back to them, so he'll play a lot. And Grant Delpit, you know, Grant Delpit is one of the best run-fitting safeties in the NFL, man. I kind of like when JOK and him are playing at elite, they're like zombies who smell blood. Like they are just like knifing at a different speed in and out of gaps, and linemen can't get their hands on them. And they're just really unique football players. That is a special pairing when they're in the run fit together, when they come and bring down the safety into the box like that. So those are your coverage guys. They will bring Roddy McLeod in, the veteran who's been around. They'll bring him in a little bit too. So that's the group. When they have to bring on another corner for maybe somebody's dinged up or needs a break, they bring in Cam Mitchell, who's in his third year out of Northwestern, a step down from the top three guys. But that's the group that they'll play.
Okay. Since you did a very good job describing the secondary, I think let's talk about the off-ball linebackers. And you mentioned JOK. He's been a Raven killer from my way of thinking. He always shows up in the negative highlights for the Ravens that I can recall, including one injury for Lamar. Tell me about those guys.
Yeah, so they play him, and he'll play almost every snap. They've treated him as their, when they go one back or looks, he's their Mike. Traditionally a Will, though. He's just a, like an ace up the sleeve. He can walk up off the edge. You can play him and A-gap him, and he's special. He's like, again, I've said he's like a running back playing linebacker. You can't get your hands on him. He's slithery, fast, closing speed, but can feel out coverage stuff in a very unique way. So he's playing elite ball. And then they let go of Anthony Walker over the offseason, who's a nice player, good veteran, but who's lost a step, and brought in Jordan Hicks, who's very familiar with Jim Schwartz's scheme from his Philly days. And Hicks, who wears number 58, will be on the field a good amount and is playing really good football. So those two together, Hicks had gotten a little dinged up, but he's healthier now. So they're on the field together. They'll be pretty good. Those guys can be rangy, and they'll keep them on the field a lot. And they like to bring them in their blitz schemes, but they also trust them to play man coverage on running backs out of the backfield or occasionally on tight ends too. So fun group there. And when they bring a third backer, it's going to be a familiar AFC North name. They brought in Devin Bush, who comes in and plays some Sam for him when they go, base sets against heavier personnel. So you probably will see a little bit of Devin Bush in this game. He wears number 30 for them.
Devin Bush. Okay. How about the linemen?
Yeah, it's a deep group still. You got Za'Darius Smith, your old name out there, still playing good football. Is honestly a trade piece that they should be considering getting something for. He can still really play. They play him outside. They play him inside. Fun player, fun person, still funny as ever. Good guy, playing good ball. I think it gets hidden again in this defense. But Miles is still Miles. He's got some feet issues that are lingering that probably will cause him, based on the results of the year, to shut down his operation early in the year. But he's still playing well enough that he gets pressures and does his thing. He's getting double tripled because you have to. So those are your two edge guys. Then they rotate people in. They have Agbo Okoronkwo, who is a longtime Texan, who actually was with the Rams, then with the Texans, and then came to the Browns on a three-year deal. Speed rusher, fast, effort player, good reserve guy. Like him a lot, and he's a part of their organization for another year after this year. And then a rookie they've developed out of Missouri named Isaiah McGuire is their fourth edge. He was a fun player, very lanky, has gotten better, has got a better feel for the NFL game. So those will be your four edge guys. And then inside, it's Dalvin Tomlinson, another name that you should be familiar with, been around the league for a while. Definitely not the pass rusher he used to be, but can still really A-gap it and plug and draw doubles and free up backers. So that part's good for him. Again, more veterans because they've stockpiled these guys on this side. Shelby Harris, who's been around the league for a while, nice three tech who can play a shade when he needs to. Bull rush type guy who's, again, high effort, high energy, having a nice year. They'll play Maurice Hurst, another central part of Michigan name forever, and has bounced around after his time in Oakland because he had so many injuries. But he put together a good year last year until he got hurt, and he's put together another pretty solid year this year. And then their second round pick, Mike Hall, made his debut a couple weeks ago in Philly after his whole debacle right before the start of the season with a domestic issue that came up and is not fun to think about or talk about. And he took a suspension for that and has had two games that I think have been pretty strong. He's a really fun player inside who plays with speed and veracity and is way better against the run than I anticipated too. So those are your interior guys that play the most snaps.
So let's talk about Za'Darius Smith for a second, because this underscores something I think the Browns did really well in the front office. And they're obviously derided for the Watson thing, and it overshadows some good things that they did, but they kept $44 million of cap available, I think, to start the season, or it might've been north of that, but it was about that. And then that allowed them to make a trade of Cooper where they could accelerate money without restructuring additional players, even though 2025 is largely mortgaged away. Yeah. They largely have a lot of $1.5 million contracts on the books that there's no more juice to squeeze out of those rocks anymore in 2025. But they do have room to trade some people and accelerate money this year. And Za'Darius, how much do you know about the amount of dollars they'd have to pay to trade Za'Darius in terms of accelerated money?
I actually don't. I do know they gave him a 2-year, so they would have some wiggle room there. But I don't think it's going to be the same acceleration effect that obviously made Amari so appealing, because you were only going to pay him a little over $1 million for the year. So there would be something a team would have to work with there, because there is a second year to that deal he signed this offseason.
Okay. He had some money on, I want to say he was one of the guys who was cut, because they didn't have anybody. I mean, it was literally, Conklin and nobody else on the roster who had a positive 2025 dead money impact. So I think that is one of the things, and I know things are tough for the Andrew Berry front office, but this is one thing they did well. Where do you stand, by the way, on riding it out with the current front office and seeing what they can do? They've got one mistake and they don't get a second, but do they get to go on?
I mean, it's how catastrophic and how much at hand are you on? I mean, I was of the belief that if they even had a relatively okay year, 6, 7, 8 wins, that's crazy to say relatively okay, but if they weren't an absolute disaster and maybe Watson proved to be the part that was holding them back, that these guys would get a chance to draft another quarterback. But if it goes with the status quo, Ken, I don't know that you can, somebody pays the piper for this. Like, you cannot go 1, 2, 3, 4 wins in a year and somebody doesn't pay for it. Now, that paid for it could be they end up moving on from Watson, which I think is going to happen, or otherwise to me, it's career suicide to continue to play a guy who's not a catastrophic shoulder and ligament injury for a guy who doesn't live on the smart side of quarterbacking, the anticipatory side. He lives on see it, get out of a chaos. Like, he needs that stuff to survive. So I am, to the root of your question, uneasy about it. I don't know. Some of the draft stuff hasn't been as good as you needed it to be. The Jedrick Wills pick you had, Greg Newsome has not really panned out into the player as a first round corner you thought he should be. So you do, and especially tough because there's some situations where it's like, these guys were right there for you. Like, Tristan Wirfs was 2 selections after Jedrick Wills. Ooh. You have Antoine Winfield, and Grant Delpit's turned into a nice player, so this is definitely picking nits, but Antoine Winfield was the pick right after Grant Delpit. It's like, there's some guys who are just better, right? You took Anthony Schwartz, and Amon-Ra St. Brown is still on the board. And I'm not, that's being very picky on some mid-round guys there, but like, you do have these situations where it's like, when this stuff gets tight, Ken, when you're losing games and everything you've done is being picked apart, you start to get people squinting their eyes at what you've done. And you start to get over analysis. Do I think the process they have is good? Yes. Do I think there are things they need to clean up? Yeah. I don't think any front office is above that. Do I think it'd be bad to keep them? No. I think I could believe in what they're doing and give them a chance. But I also understand the flip side of it now. For the first time in years, understand people having doubts. I think that's beyond fair at this point. So whereas in the year when they got the extensions, both Kevin and Andrew Berry before the season, I'm like, all right, man, probably another 3 years of these guys before you have to critically think. I mean, there's a lot of ball left. There's 2 months. They could go on a nice run to get some respectability here. But we are at a point now where I think it's like taking out a coin and flipping it is now a realistic possibility for what side of that scenario plays out, you know?
All right. Ask one more question defensively, and then we'll close this out. But we just saw the Tampa Bay Buccaneers load the line of scrimmage, and the week before, the Commanders do the same thing, and it was ridiculous this last week. I mean, I'm sure you follow this kind of stuff, but the Bucs used only 4.15 defensive backs per play against the Ravens. So it's basically playing base every single play almost. Okay. They used 4.84 players at the line of scrimmage. So they weren't off ball linebackers. They play a committed nickel. They play 2 off ball linebackers basically every single play. Do you think we'll see something like that against a pick your poison offense like the Ravens, where you have to kind of decide what you're going to be good at and just hope for the best on the other?
My hunch is that they'll be who they are. I think they trust Grant to be a box player for them, and they trust JOK and Hicks to be I listen, put it this way, Ken. I think that teams have beat them. The last two teams, Philly and Cincy, who are no joke talent wise, have beat them because they've hit some downfield throws. Like AJ Brown had a couple downfield throws. Martin Emerson's struggling. He's not playing his standard of the first 2 years. And you know, this can sometimes be capricious with defensive backs because it's all magnified on two or three plays. But AJ Brown hit a couple big throws on him, and then they shut down Saquon Barkley, and then they shut down really Cincinnati's run game entirely. And then it was a couple Jamar Chase catches and a T. Higgins slant that beat them. I mean, they held Cincy to 14 points, gave up an opening kick touchdown. They're playing good defense. I think they trust in their attacking nature of the defense. Do I think they'll play some more base? Yeah, I think you'd be crazy not to match some personnel, but I think they trust their guys enough to maybe say this week, maybe we take Greg Newsome off the field a little bit because he's less inclined to be a run fit guy, and we play more maybe 4-2-5 stuff and bring Rodney on and play him a little. Then maybe we play more Grant down in the slot and trust his ability to play the curl flat when we go zone or match up one on one with a bigger body receiver, or if they slip Mark or Isaiah into the slot, they can play those guys. Like I don't think the Browns' identity with Schwartz will change much because of this game. I would be pretty surprised if we see like 38, 45 snaps of base. I would be surprised. That's not their best 11. And ultimately they just want to get their best 11 out there because they think those guys, if they're moving Grant down, he's talented enough to do the things in a hybrid role that if we just stuck a backer on the field, he could do. Right. So I'm fascinated on that side, at least. I don't know. The offense stuff is just whatever. I've gotten ignored that so bad to watch, but the defense chess match of this game will be fun to watch. If the Browns are engaged, hopefully they're engaged because they can do some unique things with personnel I don't think every team can do. So I will be very, very interested because again, talking four straight, AFC Offensive Player of the Week awards between those two guys in the backfield. So, there's also two, like, these guys aren't afraid of Lamar. They played him enough. They know who he is. They played Derrick Henry and shut him down the year before at Tennessee. I know it's all different schematically, so I just don't think there's any fear there, right? But I expect Baltimore to have their way with him here and there. They will. I think it's going to happen. But I think this is from that side. The game entirely, it's Baltimore's game to win. But I think as far as those sides go, at least early in the game when it's neutral and maybe the Browns are not like, oh, we're not going to score, this is getting old and boring really quick. How the chess match goes there and how they play them will be good. And I think Baltimore's offense, I would imagine those guys in the locker room are pumped to play the Browns because they know this is a defense that's every bit as good as most that they will play in the biggest moments of their season.
Yeah, it's definitely looking forward to two Browns games here. Will be some of the more difficult matchups they've certainly had. Jake, always a pleasure to hear your side of things, to talk football with you. I relish these conversations you ever have. I appreciate you spending over an hour with me. Tell folks where they can find your work online.
Yeah, we started a new site this year completely dedicated to film breakdown. So we're quite simply brownsfilmbreakdown.com. So you can come over there and be a free member of what we do, because I wouldn't expect Baltimore people to care enough to contribute as a supporter. But yeah, we have some free stuff that we offer if you're ever interested in it. And we're obviously on all the social channels under Browns Film BDN or Breakdown, whatever the handle character limit will allow us to have. So you can find us those places. And then yeah, that's it, man. Browns Film Breakdown. And there's a podcast every morning as well we try to get up to. So that's what we do, a lot like you, my friend.
You did some OBR work in the past year. Are you still with them on any kind of ancillary role?
No. To get an opportunity to do my own thing, I did have to let that go, which was tough. Love those guys. Big, big fan of what Barry McBride has done there. And I will always be indebted to him for helping me establish a brand of my own. So, yeah, definitely the OBR is another great, great. You mentioned the water cooler, great resource for Brown stuff. If your folks are wanting to tread into those, I will warn them, dangerous waters right now for sure.
Yeah, it's not something I never post there, but I always try and get the feeling of the opposing fan base. Yeah. You just really get a good understanding, I think, of what's going on by reading the board sometimes. But Jake, really appreciate you coming on. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. I'm always looking for interesting new Ravens content that can be presented and discussed in about 20 to 25 minutes. And we'll create some content that way. Hit me up and I'll get right back to you about the possibility of doing a show. Jake, thanks again for coming on.
Ken, my pleasure, man. Anytime.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan.
If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health. A world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.